My name's Michael. I'm an alcoholic. Okay, I had two readers that were, Chandler and Chloe? Are they here? You guys want to come up? So every time we take a break, we'll change readers because I need people to read. And who does not have a big book with them? Everybody has their big book? You need a big book? You've got one? Okay. We've got extra big books. If anybody doesn't have one, raise your hand. We need a few books up here. Two books.
We like to call ourselves the 5-4 Posse.
Sure.
Can you teach us how to swing dance?
Big book up in the air. Does anyone else need a big book?
Fish thing on.
There are pictures. You just have to use a visual.
Is this thing on?
All right, settle down. Golly, what have I just wrong? Okay, I was talking a little bit last night about the big book, and there's many approaches of doing the steps. What I call mine is a 12-step journey through the big book, and there's many approaches to doing the steps out of the big book. And those that were here a couple years ago, you guys got to hear Don P., and he does something that's called the process, which is fabulous. And then Joe and Charlie do a big book study, which is fabulous. And everybody kind of just has, their way of doing it. And I think it's usually, for me, the way I do it is the way somebody took me through the steps. And so, I favor that because that's the way I did it, and it saved my life. So this is just another approach. It's not the right way or the better way. It's just a way. And just continue going to book studies. You can change formats. You can do whatever you want to make it fit as long as it's out of this book. No. That's how I am very partial to the big book. Thump, thump. But anyway, I come from a group of alcoholics that, the lineage went down from Dr. Bob. And so I want you to turn to a page in the big book. It's turn to 291. And this is a story about Earl Treat, who was the first alcoholic from Chicago to get sober. He heard about this little group in Akron that was getting sober. It was still the drunk squad. It hadn't broken off to Alcoholics Anonymous yet. But he heard about this group getting sober in Akron. And so we're just going to read a little bit about his going through the steps. And this is how it was at this time back then. And I'll talk a little bit about this, and I'll explain to you. This helps explain a little bit about the way and why I do the steps like I do. Okay, so let's start here. I'll do the first reading of just this page because I'm going to talk about it. In fact, I'm going to be interrupting our readers a lot, and I'll keep apologizing to them, but that's I'm going to be interrupting them a lot. So go down to the very bottom of the page. The day before I was due to go back to Chicago, a Wednesday, and Dr. Bob's afternoon off, he had me down to the office, and we spent 3 or 4 hours formally going through the 6-step program as it was at that time. So they would go through the steps in 3 or 4 hours. They did not take major months, days, years. They would go through the steps in 3 or 4 hours. But one of the differences, they did not have this book. They did not have this book to study and dissect. So that's one reason why they were able to go through it a little bit faster. So even though I take my people through the steps pretty fast, I have to admit it is not in 3 or 4 hours. The 6 steps were complete deflation, dependence and guidance from a higher power, moral inventory, confession, restitution, continue to work with other alcoholics. Can you see that those are our main key steps? Then it says, Dr. Bob led me through all these steps. At the moral inventory, he brought up some of my bad personality traits or character defects, such as selfishness, conceit, jealousy, carelessness, ill-tolerance, ill-temper, sarcasm, and resentment. So today, this is now our step 6. And I don't know if you're noticing here, they did not go home and contemplate on their own character defects. They did it with their sponsor, and their sponsor helped to point them out. So the way I was taken through the steps, when I do step 5, I'm giving away my inventory. My sponsor and I also do 5, 6, 7, and 8 all at one time. And this is because this is the way they did it in this type of sponsorship. So Bill made that. It was an action that they always did. They always did it. And when Bill wanted to stretch those steps into 12 for spiritual reasons. He wanted 12 steps. He took these actions and he made those into steps. So this action that they always did at the moral inventory is now step 6. Then it says, we went over these at great length. And then he finally asked me if I wanted these defects of character removed. When I said yes, we both knelt at his desk and prayed, each of us asking to have these defects taken away. So the sponsor said the prayer with the sponsoree. And that is now our step 7. This picture is still vivid. If I live to be 100, it will always stand out in my mind. It was very impressive, and I wish that every AA could have the benefit of this type of sponsorship today. So there you do see the word sponsorship. And what it tells you is that the sponsor's main job was to guide you through the steps of the program. Dr. Bob always emphasized the religious angle very strongly, and I think it helped. I know it helped me. Dr. Bob then led me through the restitution step in which I made a list of all the persons I had harmed and worked out ways and means of slowly making restitution. And that is now our step 8. And I was so thankful that that word slowly came into there, because I had so much wreckage out there. It took me 12 years to make my amends on my original list. I've created more amends I've had to make, but on the original list, on the original inventory, it took me 12 years to complete those lists of amends. So that slowly meant a lot to me. And so that brought us up to, 8 steps. And then, of course, step 9 is going out there and making those amends. And then Phil added 10, 11, and 12. And as we all know, 10 is really doing, if you really read, when we get into reading on steps 10 and 11, I used to say step 10 was a daily 4 through 9, but step 10 is really a daily 4 through 12 if you get in there and read steps 10 and 11 in the big book. And so now we're going to start reading. I'm going to get my readers to help you. And as I said, I'm going to tell you exactly how I do the steps when I take someone through the steps. We get together. I instruct my sponsorees to read 4 pages a day in the big book, starting at the preface. They're to read the preface, the 3 forewords, doctor's opinion, and then go into reading page 1 to 164. And I tell them to read 4 pages a day, 3 or 4 pages a day and no more, because there's so much in this book that if you just try to rush through it like a novel, you're just going to miss a lot. And after they get through the first 64 pages, then I take them through the first 3 steps as we are going to do this morning. And then we read on how to do the inventory. I instruct them on how to do the inventory, and they go out and do their inventory. If they have a hard time with it, which a lot of my sponsorees do, especially if they're new and their head's still foggy and stuff, they might have a hard time with the inventory. I bring them over and I help them with it. I'll sit down there with them and we'll do 4 and 5. And I'll just yank it out of them and they'll start writing it down. And, you know, I've heard people say that, they're worried that they're doing their inventory too soon. I want to tell you what Dr. Paul told me. He said, there's no way you can do your inventory too soon. If you don't do a real good job, you can go back and do it again. But there is a chance that you might do it too late. You know, if you go out there and drink, you might die. He might not get back. So you can always go back and do your inventory as more stuff comes up if you're still foggy. So I just don't believe you can do an inventory too soon. And that's my personal opinion. Now, I have, I got into doing my step work immediately in this program. And thank God, because I would have died out there. There were some things that I had to stop my behavior. If I didn't immediately get into 6 and 7 and stop 2 things, prostitution and stealing, I would have drank again. And it was imperative that I get into my steps right away. Now, my husband didn't do his inventory until he was 5 years sober. And he works a wonderful program, and he's passionate about AA, and he's a good, solid member of this program. But that's what worked for him. He came in here, and he got into action. He started picking up chairs, picking up coffee cups, cleaning coffee cups, giving rides. He got into all that action. He never got into the steps until he was, 5 years sober. So I believe when you're really ready, God's going to put the right person in your life, to direct you in however you need to be directed. He just wasn't capable. He was so rebellious. I don't know what his excuse was. All I know is he's still sober. But I just know for me, I would have drank. I would have drank. So, but I truly believe you can't do it too soon. You can always go back and do it again. So we're going to read a little bit about Bill's story. And, I was going to finish telling you. So after they do their inventory, we get together. And if I have to do the 4th with them, then we'll end up doing 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 all at one time. So we'll get together. I'll listen to their 5th step. And then we do step six. And I send them, you know, in the book it says, you know, go home for an hour, take the book down from the shelf. So if you're like me, you'd have to put the book back up on the shelf so you could take it down. And it says that you read the first five proposals and you just sit with God for an hour and ask if you've left anything out. I have them do that, but I have them go into another room. I have an AA room. It has this poster and it has lots of pictures and it has the Bill plant and all kinds of stuff. It's a very spiritual room. People have had spiritual experiences in this room. They stay in there for an hour and with their higher power. And then we come back together. I don't trust them to go home and do 6 and 7. I believe in doing it with them. We do 6, 7, and 8. And we set up a way that they're going to do step 9. And we read in the big book about 10, 11, and 12. And we have a plan of action on how to do 10, 11, and 12. So I actually get them through the steps in 2 sittings. You know, I mean, it takes a longer process, but I'm actually 2 sittings, I get them through the steps. And then everything I've done with them is all this stuff that I've handed out to you, and I hand it to them, and I tell them, now you have to go out and find a drunk to work with. You know, and that's the only requirement for sponsorship is that you've done your steps. Length of sobriety, I've never seen in this book that you have to have a year of sobriety to sponsor. You know, and I think it's a good idea to be at least at, I know some people start sponsoring, you know, a step away. They'll be one step ahead of another person. And they stayed sober doing that. You know, they stayed sober. I know one little girl who just couldn't get sober until she started working with others, staying one step. She'd be on step 2 and take someone through step 1. She'd be on step 3 and take her through step 2. And she stayed sober that way. I personally believe it's a good idea to be at least through step 8 before you start trying to sponsor. But I just know if you waited for a specific amount of time, if Bill and Bob had waited for a specific amount of time, we might not have Alcoholics Anonymous today. The one thing that ensures immunity to drinking is working with others. Okay, let's turn to page 8. And we're going to read a little bit about Bill's story, and then we're going to get into this book, and we're going to pull all kinds of stuff out that pertain to step 1. And we're going to be jumping back and forth in the book. And some people say, why do you jump back and forth in the book? Well, the reason why we jump back and forth in the book is because that's the way Bill wrote the book. He had, you know, talk about rigorous honesty on page 58. It's talking about rigorous self-honesty. Self-honesty. It's not talking about brutal honesty. And I want to tell you a little bit about Bill. At the time that this book was written with the Drunk Squad, there were 79 sober alcoholics. There were 79. And only 40 of them had input on this book. But in the foreword it says it was 100 men and women. But in Bill's thinking, he decided that, well, by the time the book was published, there would be 100. So how rigorous is that? So, and he has these 40 alcoholics that are fighting him. He'd put something in, and they'd make him take it out. They just didn't, they had especially this thing with God. And this is another thing. When we get to this, I'll share it. This thing with God. You know, there's a couple atheists in this group, and then people believe there's a being in the sky, and Bill thought, you know, felt it was God deep within, and so they had all this stuff. And so if Bill really believed he didn't write it, and they made him take it out, he'd sneak it back into another part of the book. And finally, when he was writing how it works, he got so frustrated, he started to put the whole project down and refused to finish writing the book until they kind of vetted out. But I had this one person challenge me, and he said, I just don't believe that. I just don't believe that he wrote the book that way. But, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, he has a chapter that says there is a solution, and what's the chapter after that? Oh, more about alcoholism. You know, so that's just the way he had to write this book, so we'll be jumping back and forth. In this book, it says now we're at step 3, and you're going, what happened to step 1 and 2? It never says we're at step 1, we're at step 2. So this is, and you got to also realize that Bill was trying to hurry when he wrote this book. You know, I mean, they were trying to get this book written, and that's why there's not a lot on step 6 and 7, because they were in a hurry to get this book written. But it's something they spent a very long time doing, and we're going to spend a long time on 6 and 7 today. But so I will be jumping back and forth, and if I can remember at the time something that they made him take it out and he snuck it back in another place, I'll point it out to you, because it's really fun to hear this stuff. If you have a pen, you can write things in your book. I'll tell you who some of the people are that we talked about in the history last night. And so let's start with Chloe. Now, I think Chloe's a real alcoholic. And we're going to start at No Words Can Tell.
No Words.
Page 8.
Sorry, Fred. No words can tell the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. Trembling, I stepped from the hospital a broken man. Fear sobered me for a bit. Then came the insidious insanity of that first drink. And on Armistice Day, 1934, I was off again. Everyone became resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere or would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes.
Okay, I warned everybody I interrupt a lot. I told Chloe, I said, I'll keep saying I'm sorry. This is one thing I'd like to point out is the fourth dimension, because Bill talks about it in two places in the big book. He talks about it on page 25, and he says rocketed into that fourth dimension. But this is my favorite page where he says catapulted, because he gives you a description of what that fourth dimension is like. When you're in that fourth dimension, you're going to know happiness, you're going to know peace, and you're going to know usefulness. Go ahead.
Near the end of that bleak November, I sat drinking in my kitchen. With a certain satisfaction, I reflected there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that night and the next day. My wife was at work. I wondered whether I dared hide a full bottle of gin near the head of our bed. I would need it before daylight. My musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. He was sober.
Okay, if you have your pen, you can write Ebbie Thatcher.
It was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition. I was amazed. Rumor had it that he had been committed for alcoholic insanity. I wondered how he had escaped. Of course he would have dinner, and then I could drink openly with him. Unmindful of his welfare, I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days. There was that time we had chartered an airplane to complete a jag. His coming was an oasis in this dreary desert of futility. The very thing, an oasis. Drinkers are like that.
Okay, I want to tell you about that jag that he completed, because people always ask me what that meant. But and maybe somebody here knows the history. You guys know the history pretty well. Maybe you can remind me what airport it was. There was an airport in Vermont. Do you know what city that was in? It was an airport in Vermont. It was just built, huh? It might have been. I can't remember the city, but they had just built the airport and this landing field, and it was really a big deal. And they had scheduled a day, the opening day, and they were going to have marching bands and make a real big deal out of it. Well, Ebbie Thatcher and Bill Wilson were drinking in a bar, and they were with this pilot, and they were all getting quite snockered. And they decided, well, that they would charter an airplane and be the very first plane to land on that airfield. And so they called ahead, and they warned them that they were coming, you know, and so, but they were all just drunk out of, you know, just drunk as skunks. As Dr. Bob would say, he'd say, boiled as an owl. And anyway, this town got together and tried to hurry and make the grand opening when this first plane really did land, so they all showed up, and they come in for the landing, and they actually missed the runway, and they went into the grass. The newspaper's there taking pictures of the very first plane to land on their runway, and, you know, that's when they have those stairs they have to walk down, and they get off the plane, and all three of them fell out of the plane. And they're laying on the runway with marching bands, the mayor, and the newspaper. Alcoholic insanity. Chandler, you want to take over? The door opened.
Sure. The door opened and he stood there, fresh-skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. What had happened? I pushed a drink across the table. He refused it. Disappointed but curious, I wondered what had gotten into the fella. He wasn't himself. Come, what's all this about? I queried. He looked straight at me. Simply but smiling, he said, I've got religion. I was aghast. So that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now I suspected a little cracked about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Yes, the old boy was on fire, all right, but bless his heart, let him rant. Besides, my gin would last longer than his preaching. But he did no ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he told me how two men had appeared in court, persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told of a simple religious idea and a practical program of action. That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked.
Okay, so remember, here all through Bill's story, we're reading about religion, because it was the Oxford group. There was no such thing as Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want you to, if you want to write the name, one of those two men who appeared in court was Roland Hazard.
And then if you would, in your big book, underline that was 2 months ago. So in a two-month period, Effie Thatcher had gone through his steps, and he's already going out there carrying the message and working with others. Okay, go ahead. He had come to pass his experience along.
He had come to pass his experience along to me, if I cared to have it. I was shocked, but interested. Certainly I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless.
Okay, you want to take page 11? Turn to page 11. And Chloe, but my friend sat before me.
But my friend sat before me, and he made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he had admitted complete defeat. Then he had, in effect, been raised from the dead, suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he had ever known. Had this power originated in him? Obviously, it had not. There had been no more power in him than there was in me at that minute, and this was none at all. That floored me. It began to look as though religious people were right after all. Here was something at work in a human heart which had done the impossible. My ideas about miracles were drastically revised right then. Never mind the musty past. Here sat a miracle directly across the kitchen table. He shouted great tidings.
Okay, page 13. At the hospital, and this is Bill in the hospital for the last time. Go ahead, Chandler.
At the hospital, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of delirium tremens. There I humbly offered myself to God, as I then understood him, to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away, root and branch. I have not had a drink since. My schoolmate visited me, and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. We made a list of people I had hurt or toward whom I felt resentment. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability.
Can you see that paragraph as Bill actually going through the steps? And did you notice they weren't numbered? Okay, Chloe, you want to take the next paragraph?
I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Never was I to pray for myself, except as my requests bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure.
Okay, I want you to pay attention to that sentence that says, never was I to pray for myself except as my request bore on my usefulness to others. Keep your finger in this page because we're going back to this page, and I want you to turn to page 87. Because Bill reiterates this. Go to the paragraph where it says, and this is on step 11, and he brings this up again. It says, we usually conclude the period of meditation with a prayer that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be, that we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. We ask especially for freedom from self-will and are careful to make no request for ourselves only. We may ask for ourselves, however, if others will be helped. Now, a lot of people take these paragraphs to mean that you can't pray for yourself. This is telling us we can pray for ourselves if it will benefit other people. And I was told by the old-timers in the Long Beach area that this is a program of attraction. And if you're out there groveling and you're unemployable and you're living on welfare and you're sick and you don't have a car, you're not much of an attraction to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. God wants us to be the very best that we can be. And so I was told it was fine to pray for things like the right car. If I have a good running car, I can take people to meetings. I can get to meetings. It's fine to pray for the right job. I can be self-supporting through my own contributions, and I can put $2 in the basket. Actually, back then it was $1 in the basket. It's even fine to pray for the right relationship because that's a natural instinct that God gave us. I was told that I could not pray for specifics. Like, I couldn't pray for that Mercedes. So that was a little bit selfish and self-centered. And for that guy to walk in the door and say, oh, I know that's God's will for me. No, that doesn't work either. Been there, done that, doesn't work. So it is fine for us to pray for ourselves if it will benefit other people. And being the very best that we can be, being an example and an attraction. It's fine to pray for ourselves because people will be attracted to us and attracted to our program and attracted to Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay, but my friend promised, who was reading? On page 13. Go back to 13.
My friend promised when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems. Belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. Simple, but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things to the Father of Light who presides over us all. These were revolutionary and drastic proposals, but the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory, followed by such a peace and serenity as I had never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up, as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. For a moment I was alarmed and called my friend the doctor to ask if I were still sane. He listened in wonder as I talked. Finally, he shook his head, saying, "Something has happened to you I don't understand, but you had better hang on to it. Anything is better than the way you were." The good doctor now sees many who have had such experiences. He knows that they are real. While I lay in the hospital, the thought came that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given to me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They, in turn, might work with others. My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. If an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials in those spots ahead. If he had not worked, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that.
Okay, so I was told when I went through the steps and the way that we're doing it, of course it was one-to-one, it wasn't in a group. It was emphasized to me that particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. And I was told right then and there that I had to work with others. I had to take people through the steps as I was taking through the steps. Not in the same way if I had a different way, but it was imperative that I did this kind of work with other people. And the one sentence I want to point out to you down here is the sentence that says, "For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead." That sentence basically tells me two things. First of all, it tells me if I'm not working with others, I fail to grow spiritually. I can pray, I can meditate, I can go to church. But if I'm not working with others, I fail to grow spiritually. Most of the religions I know, if that's what they teach anyway, is to go out there and help your fellow man. So working with others is how you grow spiritually. And then it also tells us that if we're not working with others, we're not going to survive those certain trials and low spots ahead. It's pretty much guaranteeing we're going to have trials and low spots ahead. People think they get sober and all their problems are over, and that's just not true. You know, life happens on life's terms. We still get old. People still die. People still have accidents. As you heard my story last night, my daughter was kidnapped. Things still happen, and it's working with others that are going to get you through these trials and low spots. I'm going to tell you a couple of stories that had such an impact on my life, and the only way I got through them was because I was working with others. And I was at a period of sobriety. I guess I had about 13 years of sobriety, and my mom was dying of cancer. And it was a hideous death. You know, it was a hideous death, and she was drinking on top of morphine up until the day she could no longer swallow. And I was struggling trying to take care of her. I had a full-time job, and I was even taking my mom. Thank goodness I was business manager, and I had some clout there. I was taking my mom to work in a wheelchair so I could do my work and take care of my mom. And I'd take care of her at nights. And then, thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, the women I sponsor. You know, sometimes I sponsor so many women, and I never turn anybody down. I feel like God knows what he's doing, and they're going to fall off if they're not serious. And I sponsored so many women, I thought, I just can't do this. You know what? When I needed them, those women were there for me. I only had one sponsor. But I had lots of sponsorees, and all those sponsorees came to my aid. They would watch my mom for me so I could go speak at a meeting. They would make food, and they would bring it over. They were there for me, and my sponsorees got out of themselves, and they took care of me and helped take care of my mom. But, you know, in God's infinite wisdom, at that time in my life when I felt like I had nothing more to give, God brought me a wet drunk to work with, and boy, was she wet. Oh, my God, was she wet. And she stayed wet for a very long time. She kept coming to meetings drunk, and she followed me around. I guess she thought she'd get this program through osmosis, and I was sharing with some girls that Susie bought me at Christmas time. Her name is Susie. At Christmas time, Susie bought me a first edition Big Book because she knew how much I loved the Big Book. And she had to search all over for this, and it was very, very expensive. And she was drunk as a skunk when she gave it to me, you know. And it was Christmas Eve. And, you know, what do you say to somebody? You know, I didn't know what to do with this book because I really wanted it, you know. But she was really drunk, you know. And so I called my sponsor the next day, and I said, Polly, I just don't know what to do. Susie is drunk. I mean, she gave me this first edition Big Book for Christmas, but she's drunk. And Polly said, oh, my God, Michael, you earned that book. You keep it. Because I had been through so much with Susie when trying to deal with my mom. But, I mean, Susie would do the most horrendous things. She'd always sit next to me in the front row of a meeting, and she just reeked of alcohol, and she'd get right in my face, and she'd say, I've been good today. And I couldn't believe the stupid thing she did. She saw that book, New Pair of Glasses, with these big glasses. And because I wore glasses and my sponsor wore glasses, Susie went out and bought glasses that she didn't need. And she sat there in the meeting. And she looked at me with her glasses, you know, like, I'm going, Susie, do you need those glasses? And she goes, well, it's a new pair of glasses. You know, I'm going, oh, my God. I was speaking in this huge meeting, and I mean, in California, the meetings were huge, and they're about this size, just a regular meeting. And I was standing up here at the podium talking, and I was right in the middle of my talk, and she came stumbling in the back door because she was drinking and driving, and she was so drunk, I told her that she couldn't go to this meeting with me. You know, so I went to the meeting, and I really left her with some other people, but somehow she escaped, and she found her way to this meeting. I couldn't believe it, and she stumbles in the back door, and she's drunk, and she knocked over a couple of chairs, and she knocked over the table, and she announced to the whole group that the speaker was her sponsor. And I just wanted to crawl under the table, you know. Susie, sit down, you know. And then the final thing, this was just, I couldn't believe this one. On New Year's Eve, I was speaking at a big conference on New Year's Eve, and it was a huge group and a huge celebration. And in California, you're instructed to thank the speaker. Whether you like him or not, you're supposed to just go up and thank him. And so Susie's in this long old line to thank me, and she's drunk. She's in a blackout, and she has no memory of this, and she hates me sharing it, but I can't help it. It's so funny. I just can't help it. So every time I share it, I send her the tape. I just want her to remember and to stay humble. Now, anyway, so she came up, and she's in this big long line at this meeting, and she gets up to me, and she laid a lip lock on me like I was a man in front of all these people. And I just stood there, and I just was shocked, and it was all this alcohol, and I went like that, and I'm trying to spit it out. And as soon as she kisses me, she goes, bye-bye. She just took off, you know. And the secretary's standing there, and she goes, God, I hope you know her. You know? Because I'm wiping this off. And but the main story about Susie is, you know, she kept coming to, she's the perfect example of keep coming back, because she kept coming to meetings drunk. And it's really hard to give up on somebody who comes to meetings drunk. I mean, I kept thinking she must want this or she wouldn't be wasting a good drunk on a meeting, you know. And so I never really gave up on Susie, but she was drinking and driving, and she had somebody else I sponsored in a car with her, and she almost got into an accident. And that's when I really started to put the brakes on with Susie. You know, every day I was on my knees praying for her. I was praying that, this is my prayer. I wasn't praying for Mom. I wasn't praying for me and my situation with my job and trying to take care of my mom. Every morning I just hit my knees before I'd go in and take care of my mom, and I'd say, God, please, don't let Susie kill herself or another human being. That was my prayer every day. That's about all the time I had for prayer and meditation. And Susie ended up getting on the freeway, going the wrong way, hitting an oncoming car and a center divider, and totaled both cars, and both drivers walked off unharmed without a scratch. And sometimes I get the chills when I think of the power of prayer, you know. And Susie got into her, was arrested. She was put in jail and eventually ended up in another recovery home. And that wasn't enough to get her sober. And she continued drinking for a little bit longer. And finally one day, and she was drinking, she was riding her bike, she's very athletic. We're going to read this in chapter 3. She'd ride her bike like 50 miles, and she'd have this water bottle at the bottom full of vodka. So she'd go on these long rides at this treatment center with these bottles of vodka. And finally something happened, and she was busted for drinking. And so at 6 o'clock in the morning, At 6 o'clock in the morning, do I need to do anything up here? No? You okay? Okay, all right. At 6 o'clock in the morning, she called me up, and she told me, she said, Michael, I've been drinking, you know. And I said, Susie, I know you've been drinking. And I said, I just don't know what to do for you. I can't get you sober enough to get you through the steps. Did he fall? Okay. Everything okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
We break for alcoholics. Anyway, and so Susie called me, and she told me that she was drinking, and I basically said, I just don't know what to do for you, Susie. I just don't know what to do. Now, in the meantime, I'd already set up this thing with Dr. Paul, because I took her out to dinner with Dr. Paul the week before, and I told Dr. Paul the problems I was having with Susie. And so I said, Susie, you live really close to Dr. Paul right now. I want you to give him a call. And so Susie called Dr. Paul at 6 in the morning, and she says, Dr. Paul, this is Susie, and I've been drinking. Dr. Paul, he does not like getting up at 6 in the morning, I'll tell you that. Dr. Paul goes, Susie, you've been drinking? And she says, yes. And he says, how long have you been drinking? And she says, for about 3 months. And he said, you've been drinking for 3 months, and you're calling me at 6 o'clock in the morning? Call me at 11! And he slammed the phone down. And Susie was so upset. She thought, how could somebody who has a story in the big book treat a newcomer like that? And she was in no way ever calling Dr. Paul again. So anyway, Dr. Paul finally called the treatment center and got the head of the treatment center to make Susie call him. And so Dr. Paul just read her the riot act, and he told her that she was to call him every morning at 10 o'clock in the morning for 30 days. And he wanted to know what the first step meant to her. And I don't know why it worked, but it worked, you know. And so she'd call him, and when Susie was this college-educated intellectual, and she would give him what she thought he wanted to hear, this big old psychobabble thing because he's a doctor about the mental obsession coupled by the physical out, you know, all this stuff. And he'd go, Susie, you're going to get drunk. Call me tomorrow. And he'd slam the phone down. And every day he'd say, Susie, you're going to get drunk. Call me tomorrow. And he'd slam the phone down. And so finally, around the 28th day, she was so upset, you know, that she wasn't drinking. For some reason, she wasn't drinking. I don't know if his attitude just pissed her off or what, but I couldn't get her to that point. She wasn't drinking. And finally, on the 28th day, she was crying and she was so upset. And Dr. Paul goes, Susie, are those tears? And she goes, yes, I just don't know what you want of me. And he says, nice touch. Call me tomorrow. And he slammed the phone down. You know, and to hear Susie share this story, it's absolutely hysterical. So finally, on the 30th day, Susie calls Paul, and she goes, okay, Paul, I give up. I just give up. I don't know what you want of me. I just can't stay stopped. For some reason, that worked for Paul, and he says, that's right, Susie. You can stop, but you just can't stay stopped. And they were able to do a little bit of step work on step one, and then Paul just turned her back over to me, and I got Susie through all of her steps. And Susie today now, and I could cry when I see Susie today, because she's the first one. When a newcomer walks in the door, she goes up to him right away with the big book and nabs them. And today she has 7 years of sobriety. She got married, her first marriage last year on my natal birthday at the age of 40, and then just a few weeks ago she had her first baby at the age of 41. And those are her lifetime dreams, is just getting married and having children. That's all she ever wanted, and they're finally starting to happen. And she's such a joy, and it's just because she kept coming to meetings drunk. Because you can't give up on someone who keeps coming to meetings drunk. Another story I want to share you about with working with others. And as I said, that experience with Susie got me through my mom dying of cancer. When I got married and I moved to Georgia, I had a very hard time. I was 16 years sober, and I met the man of my dreams, and he swept me off my feet. And for the first time in my life, I didn't even have to work for a living. I had everything at my disposal. I mean, it was like a fairy tale romance. You know, it was an absolute fairy tale romance. We met at a conference, an AA conference. He's passionate about AA. He courted me. He proposed to me. Gave me an engagement ring. It was just a fairy tale romance. We got married on the beach where we met. We had a rainbow out, and 6 dolphins came to the wedding, and you just name it, and it was wonderful. This is so corny. I'm embarrassed to share this with you. I actually live on a street called Sir Lancelot Court. I mean, now, is that corny or what? That is really corny. And I just love this man, but I adore this man, but it was just so hard for me. I'd lived in California for 45 years, and I moved to Georgia, and I'm not in Atlanta. If I was in Atlanta, it might have made a difference, but I'm in Augusta. I'm in Evans, a suburb of Augusta, right on the border of South Carolina, and it's very, very different. It was a culture shock. It was an absolute culture shock. Now, those that I've already hung out with that know me already know I'm an animal lover. There is no way I'm going to watch a lobster be boiled. It is not going to happen. I will not go there. I cannot watch that. I mean, I'm an animal lover, and I moved to Georgia, and anything I know about deer is Bambi, and I love Bambi. And I moved to Georgia, and everybody shoots Bambi. I mean, there were dead deer everywhere. If something moved, somebody shot it. And I had a squirrel in my tree, and the next-door neighbor shot the squirrel in my tree, and I was so upset with I told my husband, I said, I just can't believe it. I just can't believe it. If it moves, they shoot it. At least in California, we don't shoot the animals. And he says, no, you just shoot each other. But the worst thing that happened to me is I also went into menopause. And all I can say is menopause, what an order. My husband just can't go through with it. And menopause was... Menopause was very, very dramatic for me. You know, I had a sleeping disorder. I didn't sleep for weeks at a time. I had migraine headaches. I was depressed. I would just pace. And sometimes in a meeting, I'll see a man hit if I talk about menopause from the podium. I believe if something takes you to your knees, you need to be talking about it from a podium of how you got through it in sobriety. And I'll see a man hit his wife and go, that must be what's wrong with you. You know? But this is the thing. This is the thing that... that period, because I didn't know what was happening to me. I thought I was having a nervous breakdown. I wanted to go back to California. I mean, I desperately loved this man. He was so good, but I just wanted to go back to California, and I'm so glad I had the sponsorship I had. My sponsor told me I made a commitment as a sober woman, and I wasn't 1 year sober or 2 years sober. You know how we make those stupid commitments. I mean, I made a commitment, solid program. I made a commitment to marriage to a wonderful man, and she told me a nervous breakdown was not a good enough reason to go back to California. And so I'm glad I got that kind of sponsorship, and I was forced to walk like I talk. You know, and it's this sentence that tells me I'm not going to survive this unless I'm working with others. And I'm in a place where at my meeting there weren't women. There weren't newcomers, so I had to go to another area. I had to drive about a half hour to a newcomers meeting, and I started sticking my hand out to those newcomers, and I started giving them my phone number. And I not only gave them my phone number, I got their phone number, because it's hard for newcomers to call. And I started calling those newcomers, and I finally started sponsoring, and I finally started getting better. And I want to tell you about two of the women that God brought to me at that time in my life, and they were such gifts. And one of them's name was Vivian, and as I'm having nervous breakdowns, and I'm having surgeries, and I'm having all this stuff, and this woman comes into my life whose problems were a little greater than my own, and she was trying very hard to stay sober. She had not had a drink in about 4 years because she was doing the marijuana maintenance program, and she kept thinking that if she could smoke a little pot before she did her inventory, she'd do the most perfect inventory. Well, she never quite got through that inventory, so when I started working with her, she gave up the pot, and we got through her steps. And at the top of her list, she had to list her daughter, Tina. She had to make her amends to her daughter, Tina. And Tina was 9 years old, and Tina died in a car accident as a direct result of Vivian's alcoholism. And this is just, you know, Vivian herself was in the hospital for over a year with her own injuries, and that was the perfect excuse when she got out of the hospital to continue drinking. Was the death of her daughter. She never took responsibility. And so I told her that she needed to write her daughter a letter, and I was told in AA, you don't have to do anything alone, and that I would go to the graveside with her because she never even saw her daughter's grave. And we went to the graveside in Columbia, South Carolina. She wrote this beautiful letter, and in this letter she invited Tina's spirit to stay with her to help her help other mothers to recover so more children don't have to die of this disease. And she buried her AA chip. And a lot of spiritual things happened at the graveside. It was 105 degrees outside. When she started reading this letter, this cool breeze came, and it started blowing. And my hair was blowing back, and her hair was blowing back. The temperature dropped down to about 80 degrees. And we kind of were stunned, and we looked around at the trees, and none of the trees were blowing. It was just right around us in the grave. And as soon as she read the letter and she dropped the chip into the hole and we covered up, the breeze just stopped. It absolutely stopped. And I had just had surgery and I was not in good shape, but I knew that this was more important because she was suicidal. And so I went and I sat in the car to leave her with her daughter's memory for a few minutes. And just before I went into this car, this little ladybug flew past me, and it flew onto Vivian's arm. And I didn't really realize what was happening. I knew something was spiritually happening because of that breeze, but I didn't know exactly what was happening. And I sat in the car for about a half hour with the air, for about 20 minutes with the air conditioner on, and Vivian finally got back in the car, and she told me that she could not leave while that ladybug was on her, because when her daughter was alive, ladybugs were her very favorite thing. And so we don't believe that the spirit was in the ladybug or anything like that, but we definitely believe that that was a sign from her higher power that everything was all right. And Vivian, that was a spiritual experience and a spiritual release for Vivian. And she's one of those that works this program as hard as I work this program. She's one in Hilton Head, South Carolina, that works with others. You know, she's just the finest example of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've, you know, right up there with the finest examples that I've ever seen. And I'm just so thankful she came into my life, because she snapped me right out of that depression and right out of that state of mind that I was in. And she brought me out of that black hole, because I could care more about another human being than I did myself. And one other girl that was brought into me at this period of time in my life was a lady named Amy. And it's so funny how God works. Amy, a few women came up to me last night, and I want to thank you very, very much for coming up to me. And we were sharing a little bit that some of us have other disorders besides alcoholism, and we were talking about, I'll bring it up on my character defects, you know, I have an eating disorder, you know, and some women were talking to me about that. And anyway, this is a woman who's an alcoholic, drug addict, and anorexic, and most self-centered woman I'd ever worked with, ever. Most self-centered woman. And I got her through her steps. She's highly intelligent. She's a professor at a university. And I had to really get in her face. I had to be really strong and get in her face when we got to step 8. And I had to tell her, you know, that you are the most self-centered woman that I've ever worked with. You know, you think the whole world revolves around your body. Because at this point, she quit drinking, she quit drugging, but she was into the anorexic state. And I said, your only hope is to work with others. That is your only hope, is to stop thinking about yourself. And I said, you get on your knees every day and you pray for God to bring someone into your life to help. And she never, 4 years of sobriety, never sponsored anybody. And so in my grandiose thinking, I think God's going to bring her a wet one. It's got to be a wet drunk. This is what she needs. She needs someone like Susie to get her out of herself. So anyway, every day she got on her knees and she was praying to God to bring someone into her life to help. And she said this prayer for 4 mornings in a row, and then on the 5th morning, for some reason, she was inspired. She was inspired to just stay in bed in meditation for a while longer. She was very compulsive about running. She ran 10 miles every morning at 5:30, and she'd run up into the woods where it was very dark. And because she meditated longer, she ran at 6:30 instead of 5:30. And because it was 6:30 and it was a little lighter out, she took a different path that she had never taken before. And she has a dog that she got from the Humane Society, and this dog always runs with her. And they're running in the woods on a different path, and all of a sudden this dog takes off and goes out into the woods. Now, this dog has never, ever done this to her before. And so she goes running into the woods looking for this dog. And by the time she finds her dog, the dog is licking a 2-year-old baby in the face that had been lost all night. So, I mean, all through this book, I mean, did you notice up here, spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others? It doesn't say other alcoholics. It says others. And what God brought into Amy's life was a little 2-year-old baby. And so she's in the woods, and this baby has a little T-shirt on. It's 40 degrees outside. It was huddled in pine straw, no shoes, no diaper. It had taken off its diaper. And she picked up this baby, and she walked to the nearest house. It was about a mile away. And she never watched the news, so she didn't know this baby had been missing all night. But the first house she came to knew that the baby had been missing all night. The sheriff and bloodhounds were out all night looking for it. But the police had scoped out this little area. Not little area, it's a big area. And they didn't think a 2-year-old could go further than this. And she went 2 miles beyond that. And the bloodhounds and the sheriffs could not find this baby. And God used Amy and her dog to find this baby. And that was Amy's spiritual experience. She got the feeling of being used by her higher power. She prayed, God used her, and that was her spiritual experience. And she was in Runner's Magazine. She was on all kinds of magazines. Her dog became the ambassador for the Humane Society. A rescued dog rescues a baby. You know, it was just a win-win situation. And, you know, and I get to be part of this. You know, I get to, because of being willing to get out of myself and sponsor people, and sometimes I think I sponsor too many people, I get to experience these gifts, and I get to see the lights come on in their eyes, and I get to see them have spiritual experiences, and there's nothing like it. And we're going to read that about that on the top of page 89. You know, there's just nothing like working with others and getting to be part of their spiritual experience. Well, now that I got all mushy, How long have I been talking? We might need to take a little break. What do you think? Okay, let's take a 10-minute smoking coffee break. Everybody has a goal in their life, and I've pretty much reached most of my goals. You know, I own my own business, and my husband, and where I live, and just my life today is just beyond my wildest dreams. So now I have a new goal, and my new goal is to live to be 87 years old. If I live to be 87 years old, and I have to be physically and mentally healthy, or I don't want to do it, but I can see AA turned 100. That's my goal, is to see AA turn 100, and it is possible. I just heard this guy speak at a meeting the other night here in Maine. He was 84. He was sharp as a tack. And so that is my goal, to live to be 87, see AA turn 100. Yeah, I still live on Sir Lancelot. Okay, let's go back to this page. Page 27. The one thing I did want to point out on the last, we read this. We were on page 15, I'm sorry. Page 15. And I did this little tangent on all these people I sponsor. But the one thing I want to point out is the sentence where it says, if he did not work, he would surely drink again. And if he drank, he would surely die. I had a woman that I sponsored. It wasn't Susie. It was someone else who, she went out there and she drank again. And we got back into the book. And when she read that sentence, she just slapped the book and she said, see, that book lied. I knew it lied. I did not die out there. This is not talking about a physical death. However, a lot of the time it is a physical death. I know people have gone back out and died. This is a spiritual death they're talking about. It says, then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. Okay, we have new readers. You want to give us your name?
My name is Betsy, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Betsy.
My name's Donna, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Donna. Thank you for helping out and volunteering. Let's turn to page 27. And we'll let Betsy be the first reader. And if you want to write in your book, you can write right next to where it says the doctor said. You can write Roland Hazard and Dr. Carl Jung, spelled J-U-N-G. And you'll see Dr. Carl Jung's name on page 26 if you want to look over on that page. But we're going to pick up. Betsy's going to start off at the doctor said.
The doctor said, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I've never seen one single case recover where that state of mind existed to the extent that it does in you. Our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. He said to the doctor, is there no exception? Yes, replied the doctor, there is. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. In fact, I've been trying to produce some such emotional rearrangement within you. With many individuals, the methods which I employed are successful, but I have never been successful with an alcoholic of your description. Upon hearing this, our friend was somewhat relieved, for he reflected that, after all, he was a good church member. This hope, however, was destroyed by the doctor's telling him that while his religious convictions were very good, in his case, they did not spell the necessary vital spiritual experience.
Now, remember last night when we talked into history, we talked about Roland Hazard. This doctor was in Switzerland, and after hearing this advice, Roland Hazard went back to New York, and he was sponsored into the Oxford Group, which did produce, doing his steps, did produce that vital spiritual experience. Okay, let's turn to page XXVI. This is in Doctor's Opinion. It's Roman numeral 26. One thing I also wanted to point out to you, when I take somebody through the steps one-to-one, and or I do it also in groups with guys that are going to prison with the military, my husband and I do it in groups, it doesn't take this long. I don't go into stories about Susie and Amy and all those people. We just get into the book. So let's see. It's Donna's turn to read. You want to take that first paragraph, We Believe and So Suggested.
We believe and so suggested a few years ago that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of analogy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve.
Okay, so this is talking about the physical allergy to alcohol, and I want to talk a little bit about, and this is probably not AA approved, but these are the old timers in Long Beach that that taught me this or pointed this stuff out to me, and I'm so thankful for these men in my life. These men, because there are so many people that are very intolerant with drug addicts that come into this program, and these old timers were very tolerant, you know, with drug addicts coming in. And they kind of pointed out a difference to me about the difference between, we had that one I told you about him, he wasn't, but the ones that latched on to me were. And they kind of gave me the little definition, the difference between an alcoholic and a drug addict. And they told me that if you take 10 people and you give them the same amount of heroin for the same amount of time, all 10 of those people are going to be addicted. It's an addictive substance. You give those same 10 people the same amount of alcohol for the same amount of time, only one of them is going to be alcoholic, have that phenomenon of craving. Now, the problem with alcohol, with a lot of the drug addicts that come into these rooms today is they have that alcoholic gene, you know, and that they found maybe drugs before alcohol. I mean, we're going to read in step 4, it says liquor is but a symptom. And then it says the main problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind rather than the body. And so a lot of what they told me is that most of these drug addicts were really alcoholics. They can't drink any better than the rest of us. Otherwise, they would stop using drugs and go out there and be happy, joyous, and free and not have to keep going back, you know, into using drugs and alcohol. So they were very tolerant. And and I do believe in single and purpose. I really do. I believe we're here, one drunk talking to another drunk and an addict talking to an addict and an overeater talking to an overeater. I believe in single and purpose. But I'm just talking about the tolerance that I learned from these old-timers that, you know, we might be sending somebody back out that really is an alcoholic. And so I really try to work with them on seeing their alcoholism when I'm dealing with somebody who thinks they're more of a drug addict than an alcoholic. But that's just me personally. But I was told a story by an old-timer who knew Bill Wilson, and it was a story about, it was in Brooklyn, New York, when they had that AA place, that AA place. And anyway, there was a heroin addict that was sprawled out on the steps, and he was trying very hard to get into the AA meeting. He didn't have any place else to go, and he desperately wanted to get clean. And those alcoholics wouldn't let him in. They wouldn't let him in. They were just panicky. He's no good. He's less than us. He's a drug addict. And Bill's walking up the steps, and they come running out, and they're saying, what do we do about this drug addict? What do we do about this drug addict? He's a heroin addict. He's not an alcoholic. And Bill just looked down at him, and he says, do you have a desire not to drink? And the drug addict looked up and said, yes, I don't want to drink. And Bill said, let him in. You know, so that's all, that's because of that story, I tend to be tolerant, and I believe most of these people really do have the alcoholic gene, and they really are alcoholics, and they just don't know it yet. But I bet most of them that end up here, it's not by mistake. It's one of those God coincidences, and not one of them can drink any better than the rest of us. So that's just my personal little thing to put out there, and I hope it did not offend anybody. But those are the real patient old-timers that were pure alcoholics that shared that with me. So, okay, now let's jump down to the bottom of the page. Men and women drink essentially, and it's Donna's turn? Betsy's turn.
Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, discontented, unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over again. Unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. On the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules.
Now, here Dr. Silkworth didn't care about the suggestion part. The alcoholics say suggestions. They're really afraid that if they say rules, we're going to send alcoholics out the door. So they say suggestions, so we'll get those alcoholics in the door. But Dr. Silkworth didn't care. He called those steps rules.
Okay, go ahead.
Men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal. Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me. Faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Although he gives all that is in him, it often is not enough. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. Though the aggregate of recoveries resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable, we physicians must admit we have made little impression upon the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach.
And I'm one of those that did not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. My mom and I both tried to recover from this disease through psychiatric effort. And I also told you that my mom and I both tried to recover from this disease through the religious effort. And the only thing that resulted is my mom ended up sleeping with the psychiatrist and I ended up sleeping with the minister. So, but as I said, I'm not putting down the psychiatric effort or the religious effort because our program owes a lot to both of these institutions. It's just that I needed to come I needed to come in here and be with a bunch of drinks. One thing I wanted to also, we're going to be reading some words that you might not be familiar with. Did you find out if you had a lot of those dictionaries back there? I don't mean to be pushing this book, but if some of you wonder, there is a little book out now, and it's not AA approved, but it's somebody put it together, and it has all the words in the dictionary in the big book that are confusing, like aggregate, debacle, debauch, fourth dimension, and it gives you the definition of it. And she had some books back there that gave you that. They're really handy to have when you're taking someone through the steps. Let's turn to page 21. Now it's hot. I'm having a hot flash. One or the other. 21. Jump a regular 21. Okay. Now it's Donna's turn.
Okay.
But what about the real alcoholic?
He may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. Here is the fellow who has been puzzling you, especially in his lack of control. He does absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking. He is a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Okay, save your place there. I'm going to talk about this a little bit. It's saying he is a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So what it is saying is that the real alcoholic has a change of personality. Their personality changes. Now, these are low-bottom alcoholics that we're reading about right now. Low-bottom alcoholics, and their change of personality is bad. It's not good. It's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. But in the beginning of their drinking, it was probably very good. It was probably a very shy person, became the life of the party, someone who had a lot of fear. Their fear went away. You know, it was probably a good change of personality, and that's the feeling they continued to chase. You know, and then the personality became the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So basically what this is saying is the real alcoholic has a change of personality when they consume alcohol. It doesn't say that you have to be a blackout drinker. I have not read that in this book. It doesn't say that you have had to go to jail. It says the real alcoholic has a change of personality. Okay, go ahead.
He is seldom mildly intoxicated. He is always more or less insanely drunk. His disposition while drinking resembles his normal nature but little. He may be one of the finest fellows in the world, yet let him drink for a day and he frequently becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. He has a positive genius for getting tight at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or engagement kept. He is often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor, but in that respect he is incredibly dishonest and selfish. He often possesses special abilities, skills, and aptitudes and has a promising career ahead of him. He uses his gifts to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself. Then he pulls the structure down in his head by a senseless series of sprees. He is the fellow who goes to bed so intoxicated he had to sleep around the clock. Yet early next morning he searches madly for the bottle he misplaced the night before. If he can afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over the house to be certain no one gets his entire supply away from him to throw down the waste pipe. As matters grow worse, he begins to use a combination of high-powered sedative and liquor to quiet his nerves so he can go to work. Then comes the day when he simply cannot make it and gets drunk all over again. Perhaps he goes to a doctor who gives him morphine or some sedative with which to taper off. Then he begins to appear at hospitals and sanitariums. This is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic, as our behavior patterns vary, but this description should identify him roughly. Why does he behave like this? If hundreds of experiences have shown him that one drink means another debacle with all its attendant suffering and humiliation, why is it he takes that one drink? Why can't he stay on the water wagon? What has become of the common sense and willpower that he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters? Perhaps there never will be a full answer to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently from normal people. We are not sure why, once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle. We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this.
Okay, so they're talking about, say you have an alcoholic and he's managed to quit drinking for a period of time, maybe for a week, maybe for a couple months, maybe even for a year. So he does not have the physical allergy. The physical allergy is not activated unless you put alcohol in your body to experience the physical allergy. Just like if you're allergic to strawberries, you're fine unless you eat a strawberry. What would ever possess a man to take a drink with all his experiences, knowing that every time he takes a drink, he either loses his job, ends up jail, has blackouts, his family leaves him, all these tragic things happen to him? What would ever possess him to take a drink? It's not the physical allergy. He does not have any alcohol in his body. What would make him take that first drink? And then it says, yeah, everybody knows. These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. So our main problem is the mental obsession. And that's why alcoholics have to be so very careful about transferring addictions. I know for me, I always had the mental obsession. And I still have the mental obsession. And I have a program and I don't pick up a drink, but I sure can act out in other ways. You know, I'll go on health kicks and I'll start running. I ran 10 miles a day so obsessively I had stress fractures. You know, that's how I have got to be so careful about that mental obsession because it still has hold of me today. So now I try to use it in constructive ways. You know, I have a passion for Alcoholics Anonymous. That is my passion. That is the most important thing in my life. And some people might say I do it obsessively. Yes, okay, so what? It helps other people, and I know it helps me. So we have to be very careful about that mental obsession. Go ahead. If you ask him
why he started on that last bender, the chances are he will offer you any one of 100 alibis. Sometimes these excuses have a certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc an alcoholic's drinking bout creates.
Okay, jump down to the paragraph that says once in a while.
Once in a while he may tell the truth, and the truth, strange to say, is usually he has no more idea why he took that first drink than you have. Some drinkers have excuses with which they are satisfied part of the time, but in their hearts they really do not know why they did it. Once this malady has a real hold, they are a baffled lot. There is the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game. But they often suspect they are down for the count.
Okay, page 24.
The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove.
Okay, how many people here have a change of personality when they drink?
Wow.
How many people here, their change of personality is good, even now, still a good change of personality? A couple of you. How many of it is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde? Most of us. Okay. What we've been reading about low bottom alcoholics. So I want to take you to a page that a lot of you might not be familiar with. And I know I've read this book straight through. As I said, if you read it 4 pages a day and don't skip anything, you'll get a lot more out of it. Because I know I've probably read this page, but it was never pointed out to me until I did this workshop in Louisiana. And this girl showed me this page. And I just fell in love with this page. So I want you to turn to it. And it's page 315. And there's no page number, so look for page 312 and go a couple pages beyond that. And it's called They Stopped in Time. And this is such a powerful page because on this page it tells us that we welcome potential alcoholics. And this is high-bottom alcoholics. And they're absolutely welcomed here. And it's the whole reason of AA being 65 years old is we have raised the bottoms. And is it Betsy's turn to read?
Yeah.
Okay, try and read into the microphone.
Among today's incoming AA members, many have never reached the advanced stages of alcoholism, though given time, all might have. Most of these fortunate ones have had little or no acquaintance with delirium, with hospitals, asylums, and jails. Some were drinking heavily, and there had been occasional serious episodes. But with many, drinking had been little more than a sometimes uncontrollable nuisance. Seldom had any of these lost either health, business, family, or friends. Why do men and women like these join AA? The 17 who now tell their experiences answer that question. They saw that they had become actual or potential alcoholics, even though no serious harm had yet been done. They realized that repeated lack of drinking control, when they really wanted control, was the fatal symptom that spelled problem drinking. This, plus mounting emotional disturbances, convinced them that compulsive alcoholism already had them, that complete ruin would be only a question of time. Seeing this danger, they came to AA. They realized that in the end, alcoholism could be as mortal as cancer. Certainly no sane man would wait for a malignant growth to become fatal before seeking help. Therefore, these 17 AAs and hundreds of thousands like them have been saved years of infinite suffering. They sum it up like this. We didn't wait to hit bottom because, thank God, we could see the bottom. Actually, the bottom came up and hit us. That sold us on Alcoholics Anonymous.
How many of you were familiar with that page? I'd say a third of the room. That's good.
That makes me angry. That makes
you angry?
Yeah.
Well, we'll get to that on the fourth step. You're the first one to come up on the board, okay? Are you angry because you didn't know it was there?
No, I was angry because I had to go the distance.
You had to go the distance. I had to go the distance, too. So, a lot of us did. Okay, how many people feel they're on this page? I'd say a fourth of the room. That's good. I'm so glad you're here. I'm so glad you're here and you didn't have to go the distance. That shows that those of us who have gone the distance have done our job. Okay, let's turn to page 151. This is kind of confusing, so I'll read it.
Okay.
Because you guys can see it's confusing. We're going to read it on two different times. This is what brought me to my knees and brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. It was not all the bad things that happened to me. It wasn't sleeping with the minister. It wasn't ripping off the church. It wasn't drinking alcohol till I died. It was none of the things I did to my daughter. None of those things brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. This simple little paragraph on this page, it's the feelings that brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it says, the less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society, from life itself. As we became subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm, the chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. Momentarily we did. Then would come oblivion, the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. How many people can identify with this page? Well, practically the whole room. Okay, let's turn to page 30. Now, not only in California, but in some other states, meetings are an hour and a half long, and they always read, this is called a portion of chapter 3, and they always read this before they read how it works. So here we're reading about the problem, and then they read how it works. And one thing I want to mention, I got a real resentment. I'll put it on the board today. I was at a meeting the other night, and it was here in Maine, but this goes on in Augusta, Georgia. There was somebody in the back row, and they talked throughout the whole meeting, and I could not hear a word the speakers were saying. I was really struggling to hear, and they talked throughout the whole meeting. And, you know, somebody might need to hear a message. That if you need to do that, take it outside. I mean, somebody might die because they didn't hear a message. And one thing that happens to me in my meeting, I've got two sponsorees that are just, they say they have a talking disorder. They just can't shut up, you know. And they always come in, and when they're reading how it works, they start telling me all about their thing. And my husband turns around, and he gives me the dirtiest look, and he just gets furious. You know, he says, you know, newcomers need to hear how it works. They need to hear the traditions. They need to hear this. And you guys are talking, you know, and that is the truth. That is the absolute truth. So I've gotten where she comes in, and I yak at her about it, and finally I just put my hand over her mouth. You know, that's just what I have to do. It's especially important to be quiet when we're reading how it works. For someone who walks into the door for the first time, they need to hear the solution, and they need to hear the traditions. That's what the program's based on, and it's very important for us to be quiet, pay the respect Alcoholics Anonymous deserves, and let the newcomer hear the message. Okay, and so this is more about alcoholism, and whose turn is it to read? Donna's. Betsy's. Donna.
Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily or mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death.
Okay, I can't help it. I just can't help it, Jerry. I can't help it. I have to do it. I was going to practice cease fighting anyone or anything, but how many of you saw 2020 the other night? Okay, all I can tell you is I just kept thinking of this page. This guy wanted to drink so desperately. He wanted to prove he could drink two drinks a day so desperately that he was willing to sacrifice his job because he was in, you know, the business. And I mean, it was just, I mean, I just thought of this page when it came to that alternative of being able to control your drinking. And I just kept thinking, wow, our hats are off to him. Our hats are off to him. And so I want you to think about that. If you saw 2020, I want you to think about that as we're reading this page. Okay, you want to pass it to Donna, or do you want to keep reading?
Go ahead. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better.
Okay, now I was told by the old-timers in my area on this page, when it's talking about over any considerable period of time, we get worse, never better, it's talking about any considerable period of time of sobriety. We get worse, never better. Our disease progresses. Even if we're not drinking, our disease progresses. And my mom was a perfect example of this. And I thought about this program the other night a couple of these people who were supposed to be really bad drunks were able to control their drinking and drink, you know, two drinks a day. And that's fine. Our hats are off to them. Bill says we don't have the corner on alcoholism, you know, and there's all kinds of things that out there that help people, and that's fine. That's what we want. We want to help people. That's our only goal. Our goal isn't they have to do it here in AA. That is not our goal. But this program seemed to need to attack us, and that's fine. But I really thought about this one man who was drinking, and he's having his drink, and he's saying, oh, it's a good day, you know, because he can have two drinks. Who wants to have two drinks? I don't want to have two drinks. God dang, that's just not enough for me. That's just not going to get me where I want to go. But I was thinking...